This is Guy Bogart with more about our folks in fur, with a special treat for our cats listeners. Hugh Robert Orr wrote in the September number of the American Mercury a story, I Don't Like Cats. As you listen, you will sense, as I did, that Mr. Orr is writing an entertaining story which shows a lot of cat lore, and that he is by no means the detractor of felines assumed in his story. He is a retired college professor living in San Jose. A long newspaper article in the San Jose News carries a picture of Mr. Orr with three of his Siamese pets draped about his shoulders and arm. The news story states, Mr. Orr admits, but not publicly, that to him cats constitute a pleasurable nuisance, and also he loves them. Mr. Orr's story, I Don't Like Cats, will appear this winter in a publication of Twain Publishers, an anthology edited by J. Vern Shea, Jr., to be titled The Fantastic Feline. And if all the books of the little anthology match up to Mr. Orr's tale, I'm sure it's going to be a good one. Since his retirement as a college professor of English, Mr. Orr has contributed to national magazines, but let's listen to his American Mercury story, used by permission of editors and author. Quoting, I am not a lover of cats. My old Tom, Hannibal by name, who occupies a corner of my desk as I write, enjoys that privilege by special dispensation. I saved his life when he was a mere kitten, treated and bound up his wounds after a vicious dog had well-nigh made an end of him, and then nursed him back to health over a period of many weeks. After all that, I can hardly default on the obligation. But at his demise, my responsibility will have been discharged, and I shall forthwith consider myself no longer beholden to any member of the feline tribe. No, I don't like cats. I make this statement boldly and without the least sense of shame or indecency, in spite of the fact that many of my best friends regard this as subhuman trait. This may not be a rational attitude on my part, and probably Shylock was right in arguing that there is no logical reason why any person should not be able to abide a harmless, necessary cat. I suppose every family is entitled to at least one of these neither harmless nor necessary creatures, but there certainly should be a law prohibiting their neighbors from having any. The cat problem in my family isn't so bad as it used to be. I'm happy to say Hannibal is the only remaining representative of several generations of cats that have, in the years past, shared our domestic felicity. The male ancestor of all these generations was a big pedigreed Siamese, which my young daughter purchased with her own money, saved over a long period for that purpose. That Siamese was a royal fellow, well worthy to sire a noble line of posterity. I have never seen another creature, man or beast, who could walk with the stately swagger, the nonchalant, to heck with you demeanor of that cat. My daughter named him Casanova, a cognomen which I am sure he aspired to live up to in spite of the restraints of apartment life in the city. We soon became very fond of the big fellow, that is to say, my wife and daughter did. The day we brought him home in his box was a red-letter day on our calendar. We carried the box up to the living room, opened it, and graciously invited him to come forth and make himself at home. That Siamese came forth all right, but not in a manner indicative of any gratitude for our hospitality. With a fearful yowl, he made a flying leap across the room, tore down the hallway, ran into the back bedroom, and took up an embattled position under the farthest corner of the bed. One look under the bed convinced me that the wisest policy would be one of patient, respectful waiting. That cat could have held his position against the assault of anything milder than a machine gun or a fire hose. I'm sure he could have licked anything that looked like a dog. He could have taken them on in relays, three at a time, and it would have been mere fun for him. What I mean is, that was a cat. Of course, he finally agreed to a truce when I shoved a plate of fish toward him with a long stick. In a week, he was romping playfully with my daughter all over the place. He was especially delighted when we had visitors. I've seen that rascal of a Siamese spring right out of the nowhere into the here and land amicably upon the shoulders of some terrified visitor. In his sportive antics, I've seen him hang by his claws upon the broad posterior of our housemaid, whose frantic schemes bespoke no good to the neighbors concerning the strange goings-on in our domicile. Of course, most people couldn't understand a cat like that. They wouldn't have sense enough to realize that he was merely being sociable and democratic, a real condescension on his part. Well, do I remember the day Mrs. Atwood came to call on my wife? The ladies were sitting in the living room, chatting pleasantly. Mrs. Atwood's back was toward the partially open door that led into the study, where Casanova and I happened to be. The cat was taking a nap on the back of my big chair, a favorite perch of his. Suddenly, I heard a cavernous growl, and at the same time felt the slow movements of Casanova's body against the back of my head as he rose to a taut, crouching position. Looking up, I observed that Mrs. Atwood's fox fur neck piece was dangling from her shoulders. The fox head, ears, eyes, open mouth, and all swung free and fixed its grinning visage on Casanova. With one appalling leap from the back of the chair, he landed upon that neck piece, yanked it from the owner's shoulders, and made off down the long hallway, pausing once or twice to give the thing a savage mauling and uttering the most hideous sounds ever heard outside an African jungle or even inside one. On another occasion, we took Casanova with us to spend a weekend in our cabin in the mountains. There we allowed him a great deal of freedom to roam, but one day he was missing. A tip from a neighbor hinted that the cat might have been picked up by a woman who lived about a mile further up the road and who raised Siamese cats to sell. I decided to do some sleuthing. I got the car out, and we drove to the woman's place. We went quietly through the back door. Sure enough, there on the rear porch stood a box with slats over the front of it, and peering out between the slats was my cat. He let out a dismal moan upon seeing me, and I could tell that he was suffering the most extreme humiliation. At this point, a yellow-haired woman in green slacks opened the door. She made a show of annoyed tolerance and asked brusquely what I wanted. When I told her that I had come to get my cat, she gave no evidence of surprise, but at once assumed the offensive by threatening to have me put off the premises. I will not go too far into the detail about the arguments that followed, in which she maintained that she had just bought the cat the day before, and I maintained that she was a blank liar. My neighbor says he saw you pick up the cat right in front of my house this morning, I informed her impressively. The slats suddenly came loose, and Casanova, with a most profane snarl, stepped forth, shook himself disdainfully, and jumped to my shoulder, purring and rubbing his big head against my face. The woman looked very sheepish and muttered something about people who come snooping on other people's property. I never saw you so angry before, breathed my wife as we started back to our cabin. I was shaking with fright. Why, you looked as if you could murder that woman. Blame it on the Siamese, I muttered disgustedly. Cats are a heck of a lot of trouble one way or another, always getting you into some sort of a jam or tearing up the upholstery or getting stolen. Your dad's right. Cats are a nuisance. My father-in-law doesn't like cats any better than I do. He had a dreadful experience at our house one day last summer, which amply justifies his abhorrence of the troublesome creatures. He was taking a nap on the davenport in our living room. A young female Siamese we had at that time sauntered in and, finding things in a state of unbearable tranquility, decided to liven up the place. One of her stunts was to sail around the room at terrific speed, spring from one piece of furniture to another without ever touching the floor, somewhat like a flying squirrel, but swifter than a California bat. On this occasion, she undertook to break all her former speed records, and in one of her lightning leaps, she landed right on my father-in-law's face. The poor man jumped to the middle of the floor with a frightful yell, having no notion at first of what had hit him. In a panic, we rushed him to the bathroom, washed the blood from three long scratches on his face, and poured a bottle of mercurochrome over him, which saved his life but left him looking like a painted Indian for a couple of days. That summer, Casanova was stolen for good. Our long-continued search brought us no clue. We took it pretty hard. Well, that is to say, my wife and daughter did. But that's the way with cats. Some people get so attached to the annoying creatures that the loss of them through theft or accident or distemper or some other more or less unfortunate circumstance is almost as bad as losing a member of the family. Never get too fond of your cat, I can tell you. But that Casanova, he was a regal fella. I never knew his equal. He was the kind of cat, as the poet John H. Haywood would say, that could look on a king. There are many reasons why I don't like cats. I am not in sympathy with their noisy nocturnal habits. They sleep all day and then spend the night prowling about the neighborhood, keeping people awake with their infernal yowling. In the good old days when milk was delivered in big glass bottles, things were much better. Then, when the nightly backyard chorus began, you could get out of bed quietly, slip out the back stairs landing, pick up the empty bottle you had set outside for the milkman, or the one your neighbor had set out, and let it fly in the direction of the squalling pests below. It was tough on the janitor, of course, who frequently had a wheelbarrow load of broken bottles to scoop up next morning. Nowadays, it's easier on the cats and harder on the poor soul who, though he may think he has earned a nice repose, must lie there hour after hour, contriving murderous designs and realizing his utter helplessness. All this in addition to the fact that he will have to crawl out at 6:15 in the morning and attempt to conduct his daily affairs with some semblance of efficiency. Definitely the times are out of joint. Old Hannibal, who has been asleep here on my desk while I've been writing this, is now awake. He rises, arches his back, yawns, and stretches himself fore and aft. Then he rubs his long, sleek body against my arm. "It's lunchtime," he is saying, in the way a cat says things to you. I can't argue with him, and he seems to know it. He's been dreadfully spoiled by my wife and daughter. As I always said, cats are the darndest things. I never could see why people put up with them. Well, it's a delightful bit of humorous writing, and we can see all through this the great love which Mr. Orr has for the cats. Well, this is Guy Bogart with love and joy to all your fur faces and to you. Happy purrs.